Technically Legal. This is podcast 31 for January 5th, 2010. I'm your host, Dominic Robbie, and with me today are
Ben Snakeoff
and David O'Brien.
This week we'll be talking about three stories, as usual. First, we'll talk about torrent search engines, such as ISOHunt and the U.S. District Court ruling finding that they just might be illegal. Then we'll talk about whether SWAT team members can expect privacy in their text messages. And finally, we'll talk about Duke Nukem Forever, which apparently is never coming out, and the legal implications thereof. Let's dive right into our first story, which is U.S. court opinion that recently said that ISOHunt shouldn't be allowed to operate and is in fact illegal against the law. Basically, the background of the story is ISOHunt is a BitTorrent search engine. So you visit ISOHunt and you say, I'm looking for the latest episodes of, or maybe I'd like to download Avatar illegally, and I'll search for Avatar and I'll look there. I can get a file and download it. And basically, the MPAA, not liking people downloading their movies for free, sued, and this went to U.S. District Court. The district judge basically said that because of the overwhelming intent to induce infringement, this violated copyright law. And in spite of the ISOHunt's defenses, the ruling came out against them. To start out with this story, I want to take a step back and talk about the different types of copyright infringement. Like there's direct infringement, contributory infringement, and induced infringement. Dave, do one of you want to walk us through what those three types are?
I'll start with direct infringement. Direct infringement is what it sounds. It's when you're directly infringing a copyright. When you sat down with, say, a VHS tape in your old dual-head VHS deck, and you put your copy of what's a movie that came out on VHS? So they say Back to the Future. Back to the Future in one VHS deck, and you put a blank cassette in the other one, and you copy them over, and then you give it to your friend. That's a clear example of direct infringement. You're making a copy of a copyrighted work.
How about contributory infringement? Dave?
contributory infringement and vicarious liability just fall under the general guise of secondary liability. And the courts have carved out two different ways that you can be contributorily liable for somebody else's copyright infringement. And the two rules that we have now, and the courts are now recognizing that these are two distinct theories, is a theory of inducement, which basically requires that you have some sort of knowledge, first of all, of another's direct infringement, and you're inducing somebody else to infringe, either by sort of encouraging it or undertaking some type of purposeful acts which might encourage another person to infringe a copyright. And also we have the material contribution portion of contributory liability, and that merely states that you have to have just knowledge of the direct infringement, and then you have to have some sort of material contribution to the infringement itself. And then vicarious liability is sort of like this third shade of secondary liability, and that requires that you're benefiting financially from somebody else's direct infringement. So those are sort of the three secondary liability principles that were at play in this case.
So to recap, there's direct infringement, and then there's secondary infringement. And secondary infringement contains within it inducement, contributory infringement, and vicarious infringement. Is that right?
It kind of. It depends what court you're looking at. Some courts think that inducement is separate from contributory infringement, and some courts don't think it's separate from contributory infringement. In the end, I don't think it really matters, but generally you do have, you know, forms of contributory infringement, forms of direct infringement, and inducement can either fall within one of those two groups or not. It's really a matter of semantics in my view.
So returning to the story at hand, ISOHunt is actually a Canadian company. They're based in Canada, and their first argument was that we're Canadian. U.S. law doesn't apply to us. Why did the court reject this argument?
Well, just because of the nature of most websites, you can access them unless you're imposed restrictions on what users can visit your sites from anywhere in the world. So even though the servers might be located up in Canada, if a person in the U.S. can access those sites and in some way, under the law, participate in infringement on it, it's possible that that Canadian company, if it's organized as a company, or that Canadian group of defendants can then be hailed into a U.S. court of law based on those infringing activities of third parties.
Yeah, plus they had servers in the United States, and the plaintiffs in the case proved that there were people in the United States who did, in fact, download files using the using the defendant's BitTorrent service.
All right. So after they realized that U.S. law did apply, they tried to say that U.S. law actually protected them because the DMCA, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, safe harbor exception applied to them. They said they're a search engine, they're just providing information. If somebody complains about a file, a copyright owner says, hey, you've got 500 copies of Avatar listed, could you take them down? They violate our copyright, then they would blissfully and speedily comply, and thus they should be entitled to the safe harbor exception. The court, however, said that that doesn't apply to secondary infringement, that's only for direct infringement.
That was one of the things that they said. But before we really dive into the nuances of Section 512, it might be helpful to sort of provide context on why this case is so interesting. And that's because if we look back at the way that sort of peer-to-peer networks and peer-to-peer file sharing has advanced over the years, this is like the fourth iteration. It started way back years and years ago where groups of people would have some sort of central repository of files and that they would share them privately with each other, and then that eventually morphed into sort of the Napster era, where we saw distributed networks where you had some sort of host online service or client-side based software in which a person could access a list which tailed where you could find certain files, and you could connect with other peers through the client, but you were actually connecting separately with some of the other peers and then downloading the files to them. And then now we've drifted into this era of BitTorrent, which scattered the data a little bit more, and it added a couple new layers to the problem as we might apply copyright law to it. And in particular, what you use is, like I think like you said in the beginning, Dominic, is you use these torrent search engines like isohunt.com, and you can find torrent files in which you could download. And within those torrent files that you download, which are, I believe, not actually hosted on IsoHunt, is that right? Or were they hosted on the servers? Can one of you guys verify that?
The torrent files themselves, the .torrents, which are... the .torrents, I believe, were hosted on their servers, but I don't think anything else was.
Some of them were. Sometimes they would link to other torrent sites that hosted them.
Okay. Right, like, see, Well, that was
they crawled Pirate Bay, for example, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
So anyways, what you get out of this is you download a .torrent file, which is just a specific file extension, and within that small file that you get, you have to use a separate, apart from IsoHunt, you use separate client software, which runs on the BitTorrent protocol for file transfers, and within that .torrent file, it specifies a number of places where you can get the seed file, and it sort of parses out the way that the data gets distributed to the end user. So what was going on here is that IsoHunt was saying, hey, we're not really at fault here. We only provide the service that allows people to list their torrents on our site. And we index those. We provide a way for people to search through torrents. But we're not actually participating in the transmission of any of that infringing data. And that was sort of one of the key arguments that they used to try to say, you know, we're not going to be secondarily liable here because we're not really materially contributing to any of this. And we're not trying to induce people to participate in copyright infringement. It just so happens that people commonly use this service to participate in copyright infringement. And that's not our fault, and we don't monitor it, and we're not going to do anything about it.
And the court said that that doesn't work?
Well, they tried to apply this portion of the DMCA, which is the Section 512 safe harbor. And actually, there's a number of provisions, I think, that they tried to apply. The only one that the court really seemed to address was Section 512D, which is on information location tools, which is basically like indexing services. And within 512D, there's a number of requirements that you have to meet. And I think among those is that you can't financially benefit at all from any infringement that's being conducted on behalf of a third party, or you shouldn't have any knowledge of it. And there was sort of a question of what the standard of knowledge was that you needed to have, but you couldn't really be aware that there was any infringing activity going on the site. And that was what the court, I think, focused on. And they said, look, you guys have been marketing this website in order to promote it as a number one torrent site where you can find copyrighted works. They used some evidence which was submitted by the MPAA, which said, 90 to 95% of the files that the torrent files that are available correspond to copyrighted works. And so it's clearly infringing activity. And moreover, and it wasn't just ISO Hunt that was at issue on the site. The defendant, which its name was, I think, was it Fung?
Yeah.
Yeah, Fung had a number of sites which were basically torrent search engines. And on all these sites, there was a couple of common themes. And there were sections posted on each of the sites that said top downloads that are going on right now. And you could see downloads were pretty clearly infringing works, or works that at least suggested that those were infringing torrent files. And I think there were some other things which also indicated that there was infringing copies of software being distributed, and it wasn't limited to any particular type of media. It was sort of across the board. Anything that could have been protected by copyright, whether they were movies, e-books, or music, or software, it all seemed to be included within the site. And just the overall presentation really hurt these guys on the inducement theory.
And one of the things the judge focused on was that, for example, in the metadata for the site, they had the word wares in there, and that their business model was centered around advertising, which meant the more page views they got, the higher percentage of click-throughs and conversions to ads they would get, which meant they would make more money. So they definitely had a financial incentive to link to lots and lots of illegal torrents, just because that way they would get lots and lots of visitors. Some of them would click on ads, and
I think they were getting up upwards of 10 million uniques per month, too, in terms of visitors to the site. That's quite a bit.
Yeah. This opinion has quite a bit in it, and I think the last time the Supreme Court actually looked at P2P is Grokster, and they haven't looked at a torrent site yet. And this is a district court opinion, not a Supreme Court opinion. Is that right, that the Supreme Court hasn't looked at a torrent site yet?
Well, I can't claim whether or not the justices use BitTorrent, but they have not decided the issue. They have not considered the issue in any cases. Yeah. This is my new resolution. I'm going to be clever in the new year.
All right. One of the things the judge talks about here is that the fact that ISO Hunt has appoints certain users as moderators creates what the judge considers an agency relationship, and the fact that these users would help newbies find and download and properly extract and decode their newly acquired pirated files. This, the judge said, fed into inducement, even though these moderators aren't paid by Fung, aren't really officially part of ISO. They're just volunteers who help out enough to get special powers.
Yeah, that seems tenuous to me. I mean, was there any indication that Fung had any control over what the moderators did, other than that he appointed said moderators?
No.
I don't think there was. Well,
actually, the court did indicate that they didn't really evidence this by anything in particular in the opinion, but I believe at one point the court at least stated that Fung essentially had control over their actions. So it was suggesting that there was some sort of some power that Fung could have asserted over the admins and moderators on the site.
He could have made them non-admins and not moderators, but
The person who gives the power has the power to take it away.
Yeah, but I don't think that's enough for an agency relationship. For an agency relationship, you need more than the ability to terminate the agency relationship.
I will agree with that, but just to play this out a little bit, you know, I think that if anyone who has any experience on the old BBS systems or, you know, the current forum systems knows that the people that get chosen to moderate or do some of the back-end work on the forums as an administrator, it takes a long time to establish a relationship, I think, with the person who owns the site, and it's usually viewed as almost like a status improvement if you get bumped up to be a moderator on a site, and it indicates a level of respect to me a little bit that the owner of the site, you know, respects this person enough to give him these additional powers.
Again,
and that
but though,
does imply a relationship, though.
A relationship. If I respect you, that doesn't make you my agent.
But the relationship, though, is to enforce the policies of the site. So what you're implicitly saying there is, you know, I think you do a good enough job around here that I think you can enforce the general policies on the site, and I'm trusting you with these additional powers. That's pretty close to what it.
Yeah, I think you nailed it there, though. It's close to what you need for an agency relationship. I still don't think it's enough, but, I mean, we can keep on, you know, tweaking these details a little bit. I don't think It's an academic.
It's an academic. In any case, exercise. The judge felt that it was enough, and the case is on appeal, and the site is still up, so isohunt.com is still available, and we don't recommend you use it for anything except for legal activity, but nonetheless, it is still up and will remain up until there's an order taking it down, which might come, might not come, and might happen after the appeal goes through.
Here's just one thing I noticed when reading this. They said that the plaintiff said that 90 to 95% of the activity was infringed copyrights. That 5%, though, isn't that that same 5% that Justice Stevens in the Sony Betamax decision said was substantial non-infringing activities so as to not make Sony liable for contributory infringement?
Yeah, I think that's right, Ben, but maybe...
There was an inducement there, which I think is the big issue. But...
Right, I think but... Go ahead, Dave.
I was going to say, in the Grokster case, though, that was also one of the precepts that the justices focused on, and... The fact that it was such widespread infringing activity. And by the way, I think that report said that that 90 to 95% was likely to be infringing, not that it was actually infringing because just of statistical sampling errors. But I think that's something that the justices focused on in the Grokster case, and it seemed to hurt Grokster just as much as it hurt IsoHunt in this case, that there was just so much and it was so widespread that it was substantially infringing activity going on.
Yeah, and I think what the judge really, what I got, the judge hammered that this is inducement. They're trying to promote people to infringe copyright. They're making money off of it. They're listing, hey, look at these are the top box office movies you can download. And if they're, unless they're willfully blind and not looking at what's going on their site, they would, lots of copyrighted material is being, and even if theoretically take stuff when someone asks for it to be taken down, the vast majority of the stuff that's still up there and the fact that they're making money off of it and organizing their site around it implies that they are willfully inducing infringement. All right, let's move on to our next story. Let's move on to our second story. This story concerns text message privacy. It comes to us from California, the city of Ontario, which, contrary to what it sounds, is not annotated in California. Yeah. The story begins with the city of Ontario deciding to provide text messaging capabilities to its city officials, including the police department. They contracted with a company called Arch Wireless to provide these text messaging services with dual-way alphanumeric pagers. This is back in the last decade, I guess, 2002.
It was, yeah. Oh, yeah, it's the last decade now.
Well, 2001, it's a question whether the decade starts in 2011 or 2010. But either way, that's a legal technicality we don't need to get into. And anyway, they contracted with these dual two-way alphanumeric pagers and gave them out to the police officers, and they didn't set a specific text message policy, although they did have a computer, internet, and email policy that said that you shouldn't expect any privacy in your email. We can read your email at any time. Please only use this for work-related stuff, etc., etc. Anyway, our star of this story is Quan, I think is how you pronounce his name, Quan. And he basically had one of these pagers and would text on it, and allegedly he apparently attended a meeting with Lieutenant Commander Duke, who said that text messages would be considered emails and he shouldn't expect any privacy in them. Nonetheless, Quan kept enthusiastically using his pager, and there was a 25,000 character limit on the amount of texts he could send, and he kept going over it over and over again. And Lieutenant Commander Duke was basically acting as the de facto bill collector, and so he was like, dude, I don't want to audit your text messages, so you can either pay me what you go over, or we'll have to audit your text messages if you really want to say that it's all legitimate business, because we should check if it is. Worse came to worse, and Quan apparently didn't pay in. Kept going over, so the city said, all right, Arch Wireless, you guys are the ones who provide all the text messages. Please tell us these are, to see if they're all business-related so that we can stop them if they're not. And it turned out that they weren't exactly all business-related. Some were rather sexually explicit personal messages. And so The city took appropriate action against Quan, and Quan turned around and said, "Whoa, whoa, 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 whoa. I'm a SWAT team member of the police department. You have violated my privacy by looking at my text messages." And he said that to both the city and to Arch Wireless. And the case at issue is whether or not they did, and the Supreme Court has granted cert on this.
Can I go over some procedural things for a second? So this case was originally decided in June of 2008. The reason we didn't cover it then is because we weren't we didn't exist as anything at that time. So the Supreme Court very recently granted cert. They're going to hear this case, and they're actually going to hear it before the end of the year. So we'll have a decision about this by this coming June. It's a couple of strange things about that. It's kind of late for them to grant cert in it, a case that was over a year old, almost a year and a half old. The other thing is, this case is unusually what they call fact-bound. There's all of the issues in this case are going to hinge on what the facts are, so there aren't really any broad pronouncements of law that the Supreme Court can make. They're really just going to be looking at this particular case and deciding whether or not they want to affirm or reverse it. Back to the issues.
So the issues that the Supreme Court will be considering is whether this SWAT team member has a reasonable expectation of privacy in text messages transmitted on his official SWAT pager. If the police department has said that there's no privacy, the lieutenant said that pagers are treated as email, and whether people who are texting into this SWAT team member's pager have a reasonable expectation of privacy, that they won't be reviewed by the city. Thoughts on, well, Ben, tell us how the lower court on this?
The lower court, first, I'm sorry, there's one more thing that I want to go over before I go into that, and that's that there were two major issues in this case in the lower court. First, with regard to Arch Communication, the plaintiff said that Arch Communication violated the Stored Communications Act, which we've touched on before. Basically saying that people who store communications online can't necessarily just divulge them. They have to go through certain procedures. And the second one was that the city, the police department, and the police chief violated his Fourth Amendment rights. The Supreme Court is only going to review the Fourth Amendment claims. The Stored Communications Act claims are going to stay. The lower court in this case ruled in favor of the plaintiff for the Stored Communications Act claims. So, back to the Fourth Amendment. Essentially, in this case, the Ninth Circuit was looking, again, at the facts. It was a very factual, intensive opinion. You know, they looked at things like the fact that, despite the fact that Quan was told that he doesn't have any privacy interest in these emails, he was told multiple times, either you pay up or we look at them, and he paid up multiple times. And in fact, I believe he even paid up this last time, but because he had gone over several times, they still decided to look. And the Ninth Circuit here said, well, that goes to his reasonable expectation of privacy. You know, he had been given the opportunity. He can either keep them private by paying, or he can not pay and have them have his text messages looked at. So, this weighs in favor of the fact that he had a reasonable expectation of privacy in these text messages. They also looked at things like for instance, that it was unclear whether or not Quan had actually attended this. Well, Quan said he vaguely remembered this meeting where he was told that the text messages were going to be treated like emails. And, you know, that weighed in favor of the fact that, yeah, he probably did have a reasonable expectation of privacy in these things.
The fact that they would be treated as emails implied that he had a reasonable expectation of privacy, even though the police department had the internet
computer.
The fact
that it was unclear, the fact that the policy wasn't written down, the fact that it was only an oral policy, the fact that Quan didn't really remember that this happened. He vaguely recalled going to a meeting, but, and this is from the opinion now, he did not recall mm-hmm. Lieutenant Duke stating at the meeting that the use of pagers was governed by the city's policy. So there was some doubt as to whether or not he knew about the policy.
And the lower court held that?
Held that he did have a reasonable expectation of privacy in these emails.
But there was a pretty strong dissent to this as well.
There was. And in addition, the case, the city petitioned for what's called a rehearing en banc, which is getting some larger subset of the Ninth Circuit to sit on it. And I believe there is a dissent from the denial of their rehearing as well, which is probably what put this on the Supreme Court's radar.
Dave, anything to add to the story?
You guys are doing a fabulous job. Now, it was a pretty interesting story. I actually really enjoyed reading the factual portions of the opinion because I was really curious about how this whole matter came up. By the way, I don't know what the character limitations are on two-way pagers because that's really something of last decade and beyond. But interesting fact point, by the way, I did own a pager back in 1997, I think, and it was strictly a numerical pager. So this brought up some fond memories for me. But anyways, I don't know what the character limitations are on pagers themselves, but if it's anything like SMS, which has a 140 character limit, or 160 on some phones, depends how it's limited, I did the math, and I think what we are talking about here, he had exceeded that 20,000 limit in a month by approximately 15,000. So if you do the math and assume that it's about 140, which I should redo this for 160 now, that's about 286 total pages back and forth. So we're not even talking about a whole lot of pages here, and that's about 9.5 a day.
It's a lot of texting.
I know, this really has nothing to do with the case at all, but I just found that interesting that I was wondering how excessive was his use of the pager itself that brought this under their noses. Anyways, the strong thing that did seem to resound in the opinion, though, was the fact that they had this, there's some confusions in the policies of the department itself. The city had a separate policy, and the department had this, like, loose policy that turned into basically an oral policy, and it just came out by this guy who was collecting bills for the overage fees. You know, little transaction went back and forth. Okay, basically, I'm not going to audit your records as long as you pay whatever it is that you go over. That really kind of plays into, I think, what people have sort of deemed just the realities in workplaces when you give people electronic devices like this to use. And, of course, Quan, I think, went on and continued to use his pager in the same way, and then you have this little problem where he didn't remember a meeting where they said that we're going to treat this like email. I don't really even know how clear they would have made it in that departmental meeting that, you know, they were trying to include electronic two-way pagers into this new email policy, if that's in fact what they were doing. And then there was nothing in the facts that seemed to indicate that they had updated the policies to reflect that change, or that they had sent out any internal memoranda beyond that one meeting, you know, stating the change in policy. So to me, like, a lot of the factual things did seem to point to, you know, actually having some sort of reasonable expectation in text messages that were going back and forth.
And this is all sort of removed somewhat because he's a police officer and thus a government employee. And that standard for whether a government employee has a reasonable expectation of privacy in a government workplace is different from the framework whether a normal non-governmental employee, an increasingly vanishing sort nowadays, has a reasonable expectation of privacy in a workplace. There is a line of Supreme Court cases covering that. I think the O'Connor v. Ortega case being the leading one.
Right, though there is some question as to whether or not an email is the same thing as a text message for the purposes of this.
Right. So, what do you guys think, just based on your legal training and experience, without formulating a legal opinion?
I think that the lack of, you know, the clear lines in the policy just factually kills this case in some ways, but it'll be interesting to see if maybe the justices have a different opinion.
Yeah, I would normally be able to give a guess about this kind of thing, but man, the fact that there was no circuit split here, that there's never been another circuit court of appeals, or as far as I know, a state that's even decided the Fourth Amendment right to privacy and SMS messages. That just there's so little here, except for this one case. I really don't know what the Supreme Court is thinking. Again, it only takes four people, not again, I think this is the first time I've ever mentioned this on the podcast, it only takes four justices to grant cert in a case, So it may be four justices who are thinking one thing, and it may be the other five who are thinking something completely different on this case. I have no idea.
All right, if there's nothing else on this story, is there anything else?
I'm good, David.
No, we've covered this pretty thoroughly. I mean, we'll just see where it goes.
All right. Moving on to our final story. This one's near and dear to Dave's heart, I know. Duke Nukem Forever. Dave, do you want to give our audience a quick rundown of what Duke Nukem Forever was?
All right. Well, back in the 90s, in the mid-90s, let's start actually in the early 90s. One of the first big first-person shooter video games that came out on the computer was Doom. And Doom was immensely popular. It sort of changed the way that people were looking at computer games and into this whole first-person perspective. And now, even still today, that market and that portion of the video game industry is huge. Doom actually had a really popular, and shortly thereafter, this company called 3D Realms created a video game called Duke Nukem. And Duke Nukem was basically a little bit more flashy and exciting, I think, than Doom. At least most people would probably agree with that. It even poked fun at Doom. It was a little racy. It had some questionable things that you could do with strippers within the game, and there were all sorts of inside jokes that were within the gameplay itself, and it was hugely popular. After that came out, the company 3D Realms announced that they were going to come out with a sequel to this game called Duke Nukem Forever. And that was around 1998 now, I think. So we're talking 12 years ago, this company said that they're going to make a sequel to this game. And at some point within that 1998-1999 framework, a company called Take-Two Interactive, which is a software publisher, approached 3D Realms and said, we want you to make this game. We're going to publish it for you and distribute it. You guys do all the back-end work making the code. Over this period of 12 years, to make a very long story, was basically vaporware. It's software that does not yet exist, that everybody is waiting for it to come out, and there's all sorts of articles and hype that get published, and every couple of years at all the major video game conferences, a new little tidbit would either leak out or a video would be put out by 3D Realm saying, like, look at what we've done, and they give you like a little snippet of what the gameplay is actually going to look like, and the game never actually did come out. And we found out kind of recently within the last year that the company 3D Realms decided they were no longer going to make the game. And Take-Two Interactive was pretty upset about that because you can imagine there was probably an extensive contract between the two of them. And I think that Take-Two Interactive has come out and said that they fronted almost $12 million for the production of the game. And basically now they're suing because 3D Realms has decided they're no longer going to make the game. Much to the dismay of many enthusiasts of this genre, because everybody was highly anticipating this game, and it just, there were pictures on the internet that I saw too in relation to the story of people, they would like game up another brick order type, like you would, you know, the late 90s before online distribution of games became all that popular, and they had pre-ordered Duke Nukem Forever from the store to reserve their copy, and it was marked on the receipt like, you know, March 1st, 1998, and the receipt was all folded and frayed from time and sunlight and all sorts of things, and it's like people were so upset that they were never going to be able to get their hands on the game. So I think that brings us up to speed.
And looking at the picture of the receipt, is actually August 13th, 2001, and under the GameStop logo it says, don't wait for it, reserve it now for only $10 down, which I find supremely ironic. Anyway, let's talk about the legal case. Take-Two has sued 3D Realms. I think the number is $2.5 million that Take-Two fronted in 2007 and a $400,000 advance. A little bit more of the background that Dave talked about, the two people who run 3D Realms, Broussard and Miller, they actually made a lot of money off the original Duke Nukem, and so they basically financed the project themselves for a good decade or so until finally they started running out of money because the thing had not come out for so long, and so they went to Take-Two and said, hey, we could use a little more money to finish the deal. And it's unclear exactly how much money was agreed on, whether it was $6 million or $3 million, or how that was going to happen, and the negotiations. In any case, that all eventually fell through, and Take-Two said, all right, we want our $400,000 back, and we want our $2.5 million back that we advanced in 2007, or not advanced, but and we also want the source code to Duke Nukem Forever. 3D Realms says in its defense that we never actually said we would release Duke Nukem Forever on a particular date, so we're completely blameless. What are your guys' thoughts on just the skeletal outline of the case? Obviously, the case was not even, it's not even in at trial yet.
I think Take-Two has a pretty good case here. I mean, even if, so if 3D Realms' defense is really, well, we never promised we'd release it on a date, it doesn't get past the fact that they promised they'd release it at some point. And it, unless they somehow, you know, they've made it pretty clear that they're not going to release Duke Nukem Forever anymore. And I think if they had, you know, disbanded 3D Realms but kept the source code and kept some sort of skeleton crew working on it, they may have had a better case here. But if you're saying we're not going to release it anymore and you had a contract with someone, you know, to distribute the release, you violated the contract.
We're really speculating here. We don't have the contract in front of us, and any time that a game developer such as 3D Realms and a game publisher like Take-Two Interactive gets into a relationship like this, I guarantee you there is a hugely extensive contract at issue. And that contract goes into details that most people can't even think about, and if they did, their eyes would glaze over. Because it goes through the entire process of usually how the game should be created, who has creative control over certain aspects of it that may or may not be included in it, what the financials are going to look like for royalty distribution, who's going to own each, you know, piece of the intellectual property for all the copyrighted portions of the game that get created, the game story itself, the music behind it, the entire game. Who's going to have rights to distribution? How is that going to work out? I mean, that's just to say a little of what should be included in there. And my guess is, and I read that across at least one site, that people were speculating the whole one of the big reasons behind the suit was that Take-Two was really interested in getting at the underlying IP that 3D Realms was still sort of hoarding. You know, to the best of my knowledge, and to that fantastic article that was on Wired, if you haven't read it already, you should read it. We'll post it on our site. It kind of detailed the entire story as it played out over 12 years. According to that, though, they had created, you know, basically fractions of the game and then completely scrapped them at some points as they moved in, you know, between different game engines, which is sort of like portions of the underlying code that are actually running the physics and some of the graphic portions of the game itself. They went through a bunch of different iterations where they like had half a product and then threw it out. They were like, nope, we're going to start all over again. We're going to include all this new cool stuff. And they did that two or three times, and so it's not really clear what they have, I guess, just factually for in terms of intellectual property, but whatever they do have, I'm pretty sure that Take-Two is really interested in getting their hands on it, or at least getting the rights to license that to somebody else to go out and finish the game.
And Duke Nukem Fun City.
Oh, dear. Oh, dear.
Don't start.
World of Duke Nukem. Yeah. Anyway.
Right, so I'm kind of curious as to where this is going to go. I do not take the opinion, and maybe I'm just forever the optimist, that Duke Nukem Forever is forever dead. I'm going to say that at some point, something is going to come out. Even the Wired article indicated that they still thought that the Duke Nukem franchise was potentially worth hundreds of millions still. And I'd probably agree with that, even though I don't really know any of the finances behind it. I would say that If this game eventually did come out in another couple of years, I'm sure it would be bought across the board just because everyone's so interested in seeing what it's actually going to be like. It could be the worst game ever, and they could probably still sell hundreds of millions of copies or something.
I've got to say, it's never going to come out, and you're just, with all due respect, the fanboy who really wants it to come out.
Yes, I'm still holding out some hope for Blizzard's StarCraft Ghost.
That's canceled.
I know.
So,
anyway, one thing that I saw in the article that I thought was kind of interesting was that a lot of the employees at 3D Realms had agreed to work for less than the standard salary in the industry with promises of profit sharing. And I gotta wonder if they would have, and again, this is a lot of speculation on our part, I don't know how the profit sharing agreement was set up, I don't know if they already have shares of 3D Realms, and or if they were just gonna get a share of whatever the, you know, net was, or whatever the gross was from game sales. But, you know, would they have any type of claim against the heads of 3D Realms for mismanagement, which, you know, if they were going to have a profit share here, you know, are the heads of 3D Realms in some sort of fiduciary relationship with their employees? Did they have a duty to try to get this product to the market?
It's possible. I mean, again, the speculation that we're doing here probably boils down to some sort of written agreement that was at issue, and it probably, you know, that agreement probably specified all sorts of points of where there would be liability limitation or exculpatory clauses, you know, for certain events. What would happen if the company, you know, didn't go anywhere and eventually dissolved? What would happen if the employee, you know, disbanded from the company and no longer continued working there? Does he forfeit his any potential future profits that he was entitled to under that agreement? All things that we would probably see in the contract. One thing I left out, by the way, before I got on my last rant, was the biggest point, and that was in the litigation itself. It's probably going to boil down to not only what's in the agreement, but where you have conflicting views on how certain terms should be read. For instance, we're going to release it at some point, and we haven't specified a date versus, you know, have to release it at some point, or basically the competing viewpoints of when you violated the material terms of the contract will probably come down to some sort of judicial determination of what the language of the contract means or something along those lines in pretty standard contract litigation. I would suspect that would be exact too for the employees that were entitled to future profits on the game if they choose to sue separately. Or
all right, that makes sense. Thanks a lot for listening. I was your host, Don O'Grieman. With me,
Ben Snitkoff.
And Dave Ryan.
If you have any comments or questions on our podcast, feel free to email us at podcast@technicallylegal.org. You're always welcome to visit our website at www.technicallylegal.org, where you can read our story analysis, download old podcasts, subscribe to our RSS feed, and subscribe to our podcast feed. That's technicallylegal.org.
What is this, 31? January 5, 2010.
Wow, we're in the future. Hey guys, 5 years till flying cars and hoverboards.
Yes. Welcome to the future. This is Technically Legal.
Was that an XKCD reference there that the graph that he came out with the other week? With the hoverboards, 5 years?
I didn't see that graph, but it was a reference to Back to the Future 2.
Very nice.
Wherein Marty McFly, Doc Brown, and Jennifer go to the year 2015, and there are hover cars and flying cars and hoverboards.
I forgot about the year.
Yeah, so the first one was it takes place in 1985, and they go back 30 years, and then they go forward 30 years, and then they go back 100 years to 1885.
I should watch those movies at some point.
You what?